and welcome to another episode of Dear Jane. I'm your co-host, Marcy. Wherever he is, your co-host, Scott.
Person, this person. You were looking for a word, this.
No, I didn't know which side you were going to be on.
Oh.
Because you're on this side for me. So I was pointing at you, but then I was like, maybe that's not actually I'm going to not point anymore. Scott, how's your day been?
It's been great. Glad to be here. Excited about today's conversation. You know what? We'd love to talk to people who are pro. I mean, we'll talk to people who aren't pro-life if they come on, and a lot of times they don't want to. But I love talking to people who are pro-life who come at it from different angles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think everybody hopefully knows that you and I are people of faith, that sort of thing. But we've had agnostics and atheists and people from the right and the left. Today is one of those people that's coming at it from a different angle. But I think she's going to give us some things to think about.
Yeah, very creative. I love the approach. I love how focused they are on the reasons women consider abortion and how do we address those very specific reasons? How do we build communities that women can be a part of to access the support that they need? Before we jump into today's conversation, though, Scott and I wanted to highlight a cool pro-life group business that you may or may not be aware of, and we wanted to just put it out there because they have a phenomenal product that maybe you would like to use to replace a daily necessity that maybe you purchased from a company that has anti-life values. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I'm referring to is something that most of us need on a daily basis, are coffee.
Scott, yeah, I think. We're passionately pro-life without question. Right behind that probably is we are pro-coffee.
Yeah, I need coffee. There's a really awesome pro-life coffee company called 7 Weeks Coffee. I'm a current subscriber. You've had their coffee before.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about 7 Weeks, what makes them different from some of the other places where you could get your coffee.
All right, well, let's start with the most important thing. Their coffee is good. It really is good. And they're not paying us to say this. I like their coffee. I'm more of a medium to light roast person myself. But I was just now going to their website, and do you get the ground coffee?
The whole beans.
Oh, you do whole beans. Okay.
I do whole beans because then I grind it either. Sometimes I make like a French press. Sometimes I do espresso. And you got to grind it to different. Yeah, it's very specific, Scott.
La-dee-da. Well, I got the ground coffee, and it was really, really good. But now I see they have coffee pods that you can put in your coffee pod maker. That excites me quite a bit. Are you a coffee pod person?
I'm not.
No, probably not. No.
I make my espresso or make my espresso. But they have a coffee subscription. So you can sign up like if you think like, oh, every 4 weeks or every 3 weeks, however long you can make your bag last. It's just me. So I'm like every 4 weeks usually. But then I also will add in a decaf bag every now and then. You could kind of change up your subscription however you want. But they are really cool. So they're called 7 Weeks Coffee. And I promise we're going to actually get to our guests today. But I just love talking about this company because it's at 7 weeks of pregnancy, the baby is the size of a coffee bean. So that is really cool. But also, they donate a portion of their proceeds from the sale of their coffee to pregnancy centers. So
correct.
Talk about, like, we're going to talk about in today's episode about supporting women and the types of resources and community that they need. And that's exactly what pregnancy centers do, is offer that for women. So I love their mission. Their coffee is really good. It's not like cheap coffee. And for people who care about this, it's like, it's like really high quality,
If you're a coffee snob like Marcy, then you're going to like it just fine.
You'll love it. It's great.
7 weeks coffee. They give their money to pregnancy centers, pro-life, support a pro-life organization. They're super cool. So today's guest, straight out of the headlines, right? Yeah. That's how fresh we are here, dear Jane.
Yeah, just right on top of it.
So we talk about what's going on at the border. You know, there's a lot of news about what's being done with immigration, illegal immigrants, things like that. Destiny Herndon De La Rosa with New Wave Feminists joins us here today to talk about what's going on down at the border here on Dear Jane. Destiny, thanks for joining us here today on Dear Jane. Let's start with something that's very much in the news, and that's what's going on with deportation of illegal migrants, things like that. Why should pro-lifers be monitoring that situation?
You know, I think a lot of pro-lifers are very consistent in their views, right? The reason that we're protecting the unborn child in the womb and fighting for them is because they are so vulnerable and so powerless. And in many ways, I fear that we have started to view migrants as this nameless, faceless monolith, right? We're told it's criminals and it's these bad actors. And I mean, that's certainly the case with any society. That's going to be a part of it. But to a large degree, there's also so many mothers, just like many of us, so many vulnerable children, so many people who truly are escaping for their lives right now. And there is just not really an accessible pathway to citizenship if you do not have particular means. And so, you know, my organization runs a shelter at the border where, you know, we, up until this point, we're not really sure what's going to be happening with asylum cases, but the idea was we do want people to come across documented because we don't want them to be invisible and be exploited. And so they would stay with us for 6 to 9 months sometimes until they could get that asylum appointment and come across legally. And that's all kind of been shut down at the moment. And so I think that we need to care because we are mothers, fathers, you know, children, aunts, uncles, human beings, and these are human beings, and understanding that this is not just this monolith, this, you know, group of people who we've decided are all criminals. Like, no, they're very much like us. Many of them, you know, are going to be brothers and sisters in Christ to a lot of believers. And so seeing that and humanizing those people, I think is one of our highest pro-life callings.
I think you're right. I think it's easy for people, especially if they feel disconnected from the border, disconnected from what's happening there, to just make a lot of assumptions. And those assumptions are fueled by headlines and broad sweeping generalizations and policies. So can you kind of paint a picture for us of like what's happening at the border, what work your organization is doing, and tell us even like tell us some stories of women that you've encountered or that you've helped to kind of humanize this issue. So it's not just a political talking point. Give us some insight there.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to do that. So we have our main shelter on the Juarez side, so in Mexico. But then about 6 months after we started it, somebody, a Unitarian church, actually gave us a property on the El Paso side. So now we've got two shelters on each side, which is great for continuity. So we would have, you know, our families, mothers, and often small children, pregnant mothers, where we were able to get them prenatal care they needed and things on the Juarez side. And then, you know, some of them delivered over there, others, their asylum cases were able to be processed. And so they made it to the U.S. side and staying in our emergency shelter there. And the stories that we are hearing, you know, there was one, 60 Minutes actually came down and did an interview on it, but we had a mother whose child had a bullet fragment in his head. And so in her home country, it was obviously incredibly dangerous. She had to get out of there, but there also wasn't the adequate medical care that she needed there to take care of this. And so he was having vision impairment and headaches. And it was very much a timely matter where, yes, she wants to go through the process. She wants to do this legally, absolutely. But there was also this fear that, like, at any point, this could be killing her child. And I feel like so many of the moms that we see, we've had other cases where, you know, they have lost infants to starvation in these countries where it's just complete destitution. And so, you know, now they are trying anything they can to save the lives of their children. And I think a lot of people say, well, you know, it's so dangerous for you to come up here. Why would you put your children through that? Because we have to understand where they are coming from is even more dangerous. The fact that it seems ideal to pass through the Darien Gap with small children when you have, I mean, the terrain is so dangerous. You literally hear stories about children being snatched up by wild animals, like in these jungles, and people drowning. Like, it is a completely traumatic experience that they know that they are going to go through, but the trauma where they are at is even worse. And so, like I said, we receive people oftentimes in the Juarez side, and right now, because of these mass deportations that are happening, one of the things that we're noticing in the headlines is, it's we expelled 60 criminals today or 80 criminals today. And the word criminals, when these people, yes, they came here undocumented, they are a criminal in the same way that we've committed the crime of speeding before, and it's very frustrating. Like, there are other people in office who are making these claims who also have mugshots and things. Like, none of us are perfect, but if you look at what their crime is, I think the headlines are making you think that we're, deporting El Chapo and his gang, and that's just not it. It's moms and dads, it's aunts and uncles, and we certainly are seeing a lot of that on the El Paso side, where we currently have women who did come through the detainment and have something called an A number. And so they are documented. But because we're in this weird limbo where we're not sure what this administration's going to do, they're absolutely terrified. So they are here in El Paso, Texas, at our shelter. The other night, they were supposed to go to, so Karina, my partner, she's the one who runs the shelters there, and they were going to go to mass. And the women got all ready, and they were going to walk across the street to this Catholic church where they have mass. And literally, as soon as they started to step out of our back gate, they saw ICE rolling up and down our back alley. And they immediately ran inside and called Karina and said, like, we can't do it. Like, we don't feel safe, because it's kind of a, act now, ask questions later type thing. And so if they end up getting deported, which we are right at the border wall, you can see it from our front door, it's a couple hundred yards away, they could easily be picked up and just dumped off on the Mexico side. And even though they had that A number, now it would be impossible for them to come back over. And so in so many ways, I'm seeing these comparisons to Anne Frank type stuff, but like, this is the first time I've ever felt this in society, where we are literally telling them, like, hunker down and don't draw attention and stay safe and stay where you are, just because we don't know exactly how broad these sweeps are. But in El Paso in particular, Karina lives close to the border wall herself, born and raised in America. She's an American citizen, but they were doing raids on her neighborhood with helicopters flying above her. We've got our governor has a group called Lone Star. It's a Lone Star initiative. It's like a militia, basically, that they've been down there for months profiling people, and it's not a reality any of us have ever experienced. It feels very, very dystopian. And so, as pro-life feminists, and we have such a heart for our mothers, and then just seeing, the one piece of familiarity they have being so far away from their home countries is church, and being able to go to church and be in community. And I personally am agnostic, so I don't necessarily understand the full capacity, but I know when they explain how powerful the Eucharist is, and being able to be there and pray the rosary and that hug from their mother, those type of things, and the fact that they cannot access that right now because they're having to literally hide out for the safety and the safety of their children. It's unimaginable.
So it's a life issue, and this isn't just helping me understand. So it's a life issue because it's a respecting all life kind of issue. That's how it becomes something that pro-life feminist cares about so deeply. It's sort of a dignity of life kind of thing.
Yeah, to us, it's the consistent life ethic. It's womb to tomb pro-life and caring about people. But then even just on the pro-life anti-abortion side, we're taking in pregnant women. That was we saw a major gap in care, in pro-life care, when it comes to pregnant migrant moms, because they certainly have abortion is very accessible down there with pharmaceuticals, and you can just, as many Americans know, you can go there to get pharmaceuticals just over the counter with no prescription. Well, the same goes for abortion inducing drugs. And so there certainly is a target on them, and they are sold this bill of goods that, even in a different time when asylum was a bit easier and there was that pathway, well, it's going to be so much easier if you're not pregnant. And so why don't you go ahead and get rid of this pregnancy? And there was just such a target on them that, we thought, hey, if the other side, if people are pro-choice, one of the choices is continuing a pregnancy. And when you are being coerced into acquiring an abortion because you feel like that's what you have to do to survive, like that's not a choice at all. And so we just found, pro-life movement tends to kind of have different views on migration. The pro-choice movement, very pro-migrant, but also kind of peddling this lie that abortion is so necessary down there. And we don't really get into all of the legality or anything, which Chihuahua did just legalize abortion yesterday, by the way. So it is now even more accessible. There's going to be a bigger target, but it's a matter of, okay, for the people who do not want to choose abortion, do we have a safe place for them to stay? Because they do become incredibly vulnerable, especially in Juarez. It is like the one of the capitals of femicide in South America. So women especially are incredibly vulnerable there to being killed, trafficked. Torture porn is very big down there. Like there are so many horrific stories that I won't tell on this podcast, but we have written about if people, want to understand more just how scared our mothers are, even when they're just waiting out their asylum petitions over there. But we're definitely seeing that abortion gets pushed as like a necessity. It's almost kind of strange culturally down there. It's very weird to call yourself pro-life because just the extreme destitution and poverty. It's like, how dare you? That's such a privileged position to be pro-life. And so we realized it's not about calling ourselves pro-life. It's about being pro-life and acting pro-life. It's in the doing. And for us, that meant we need to provide an actual shelter for these women. We need to have relationships with physicians down there where we can get them quality prenatal care. And I think that has given us credibility and the pro-life, stance credibility a bit because we're not just talking about it, we're doing something about it. And it is only, like I said, I just have to sing the praises of Karina, our board member and the co-founder of all of this because it is such an act of love and everything she does with these shelters and how she cares for these women. And she constantly talks about that maternal heart. It's just, she recognizes the maternal heart in them wanting to do anything that they can to protect their children. And so she is the perfect person to be doing this work. And I'm just lucky that I get to support her and do the fundraising and talk about it and stuff.
Yeah, how did you get connected to her? How did y'all start your work down at the border? Because that's not, I've been following New Wave Feminists for a while, and that's not how you guys started, if I understand correctly. So, how did y'all get involved at the border and talk to us about that partnership?
Yeah, it was definitely, we were doing summer campaigns because we had kind of seen this gap in care. And so we were doing summer campaigns on the US side with migrants, but that was sort of it. And then during COVID, the world shut down and a lot of what I was doing was speaking at colleges. And so that kind of came to a halt. And I remember it was just to me, personally I'm agnostic. So, but I, it's just so hard to deny that there was some force in the universe that like made it was the perfect timing for this. It was the perfect everything. And I remember Karina reaching out to me and she said, Planned Parenthood wants access to my shelter. She was working at a shelter in part of a diocese at the time. And she said, there is a certain amount of money that they want to give us to be able to come in and talk to our women. And she's like, as a pro-life feminist, I can't do that. I don't feel right about it, but also we need to keep the lights on. And she's like, and I just, why are they trying to help us? Where are the pro-lifers? And I said, Karina, I don't know if we can raise that much money for you, but we can try. We can see. We've only ever done summer campaigns before. And within a month, we quadrupled what Planned Parenthood was going to do. And so I was like, okay, there are people who do care about this, pro-lifers who really do care about this. And so then we started working with her in that shelter. Ended up closing eventually. And then we had the opportunity to start our own shelter. It was kind of a funny story, actually. We through one of these summer campaigns, a board member had set up a PayPal link that went to one of them. And I didn't know where it was on the site, and it was a different email address. And so during COVID, people started donating their stimulus checks, which that's kind of a lot of money. And it was very amazing that people were that generous. But I wasn't seeing it reflected in our main bank account because we have one specifically for Mexico and it wasn't going there. And so finally, somebody had donated again, and I was like, okay, I'm terrified that this money's going off into the ether. Like, where is it going? So I start putting in all the email addresses to all the, different ones, and I find it, and there was $20,000 in this account, and it was all earmarked for the border. And at this time, we're just assisting other shelters, we're doing smaller stuff. And so we had this moment where it was like, well, we have to find a way to spend this money, and it's going to have to be something bigger than just handing out food and clothing and, little stuff like that. And so we found this building that would have been a perfect shelter, and we asked the man if we could rent it, and he said, yeah, you could rent it for a couple months. And I was like, okay, there. Like our problem went from never having enough money to finding out a way to spend money. It was a great problem to have. And then right at the last moment, he said, actually, I don't want to rent it. I want to sell it, and it's $300,000. And that was a number that we had never seen before. And so I just remember being like, this is a wild idea. I'll throw it out on Facebook, and I'll see, if we could possibly raise that money. And again, this is my disclaimer that I'm agnostic, but I had a friend who went to Lourdes, France, and she had prayed at the grotto like 8 hours before that we would be able to receive funding for the shelter. And so that next morning, we had a call with some potential donors, and they basically wanted to do a matching donation of $100,000. And so I was like, okay, this is crazy. And there was some weird Our Lady of Lourdes stuff happening there. And then I called this other friend. She's very Catholic. All of her children are named after saints. I was like, you'll love this story. And I start telling her, and she goes, were you able to match the donation? And I was like, well, no, this just happened a couple hours ago. And she goes, let me go ahead and match it. And I was like, no, I don't think you understand. I didn't say 10,000. I said 100,000. And the couple that I had talked to prior to that, by the way, they had asked what our fundraising plans were. And I said, well, I mean, like memes and stuff on Instagram. So they had given us 3 years to match this goal, and I matched it in 4 hours. And so I had to call them back and apologize. And I'm like, I am so sorry I accidentally matched this goal. And they were like, no, there's a higher power at work here that's like making sure that this happens. And within the next couple months, we raised the I New Wave Feminist was a MySpace page. And now I stand in this shelter, and there's like women feeding their children, and like babies running around and laughing and playing. And I'm just like, this MySpace page is out of control. Like, how has this happened? And it's just been, I guess, willingness and walking through doors that for some reason are open for us that have shocked us. But it's every bit of it. I feel like I can see where I would have been terrified if I would have known that this was the goal and how it ends. But because it was all missteps, accidentally misplacing $20,000 that then led to like accidentally trying to raise $300 that then led to accidentally raising $300,000. Like, it was crazy stuff like that. But it does give me some faith in a higher power that, like, okay, evidently this is supposed to exist. This space is supposed to exist. And there's a lot of people who seem to believe in it. And I'm just so glad that I happen to be linked up with a walking, breathing saint along the border, Karina Braseda, who's actually doing all of this work. It inspires me every day. And the beauty of the sisterhood that's been created with our mothers and seeing how they care for one another. And, they've all gone through this traumatic experience together. And then, sometimes they have really hard days, especially the ones who, have just given birth and are going through postpartum, and having another mom say, hey, you lay down. I'm going to go feed your baby. I'm going to take care of things. Like, you get a shower, you get some rest. Like, I think that's where I was surprised to find the feminist part of this. Like, I expected the pro-life part, but it has just been the most beautiful community, and sisterhood at our shelters. And I'm so grateful that I just get to witness it.
You're giving me a new way to think about it for sure. And specifically the migrant issue. Help us personalize this even more. So like right now, if we were to go down into one of your shelters, what would we see? Well, I mean, kind of paint the picture, and how is it different now under the new administration than it was maybe this time last year, if at all?
So, right now is a very weird time. So I think it's a little different, but I will say from the first Trump administration to the Biden administration, there was not a lot of difference. And that was kind of frustrating to those of us on the ground doing the work, because I think a lot of people saw Biden get into office and they were like, oh, the border's going to be solved. Kamala went down there and did one press release interview, thing like, oh, everything must be okay there. Nothing changed. Even a lot of the policies that Stephen Miller and Trump had instituted did not change under Biden. And so it was very frustrating. And then, this administration, I'm not a Trump fan, but I thought the only silver lining is people will be paying attention to the border again. They'll actually like start seeing the human beings along the border again. So right now, I think the thing is, we used to have women who came who it was a pathway to citizenship, right? So they were waiting for asylum. It appears that those avenues have been closed down. Trump, within an hour of taking office, shut down the CBP One app, which was the app that people use to apply for their asylum cases and their court hearings. It was a piece of junk to begin with, so I'm kind of shocked that he shut it down because it was the least efficient way to ever get asylum, but it's gone now. And so now we're kind of not really sure if that means that they just are not going to be taking asylum cases. So how it's changing our work is that it's not necessarily so much asylum seekers as refugees, sort of now, and we're still walking with them. Like, it doesn't change the work we're doing. There are still pregnant women in vulnerable positions who need medical care, but they might end up having to find other places in South and Central America, as opposed to the US right now. And so making sure that they can find a place that is safe for them and their children has become our top priority.
I'm kind of interested, like broadening out a little bit, thinking about New Wave feminists. You've described yourself a few times already as agnostic. The pro-life movement is, broadly speaking, majority probably Christian or faith-based. So I'm curious, like, how you got started in the movement. Did you feel like you had to carve a space, or what has it been like for you building bridges kind of between the various different factions of the pro-life movement?
Yeah, we joke all the time that we're kind of in the radical middle because we're not like the lukewarm middle. We have opinions, y'all. It's very radical, but it's still very centrist in a lot of ways. Like, we personally don't focus on the legality of abortion, which I know that tends to be what a lot of pro-life groups do, but for us, so much of it was based on my own personal experience with a teen pregnancy. And then my mother also became pregnant with me at 19 while she was at the University of Texas. And so the whole reason I exist, the whole reason my son exists to this day, he just turned 24 and he's awesome, is because of the fact that we had our basic needs met and we weren't kicked out on the streets. I had a bed to lay my head every night. I had food. I had health care. I had, these basic necessities. And so that has always been kind of where my pro-life lane is. I just want people to at least have what I have. And the odds of them making a choice for life when they feel supported, when they have community, when they have people, like, they go up. And so I think that when, we became more vocal about that about 10 years ago, that we're not necessarily focused on the legality. Pro-lifers didn't love that. I always joke that it seems like we're too pro-choice for pro-lifers and too pro-life for pro-choicers. And, same, we're too left for the right and too right for the left, but because we're in the radical middle and we just have this, like, we want to stick to a consistent life ethic, which is a belief that human beings should be able to live free from violence for the duration of their lifetime from womb to tomb. And so we are anti-death penalty, we're anti-war, we talk about things like racial justice, we obviously are pro-migrant, and then we extend it into the womb when human beings are at their weakest and most vulnerable by also caring for the unborn child. And that's not popular really within obviously the feminist movement. It's not popular within the pro-life movement, but we have found that it is kind of popular within, the 60% of Americans who are kind of in this gray area, and they will fully acknowledge, like, abortion is not something that anybody ever wants to have. It is always the symptom of a breakdown. And so they know how destructive and harmful it is. These aren't the extremes where it's like shouting your abortion or anything like that. But they also don't necessarily feel like focusing on the legality is going to be the most efficient way to get people to continue their pregnancies. And so we work alongside a lot of them. And Karina is very Catholic, which, by the way, that's why I think so much weird Catholic Mary stuff happens with us, because she's like, she makes it happen. But and so it's been interesting for me as an agnostic, like, to I'm very comfortable with Catholics. I used to joke that the only day I didn't spend time with them was Sundays, because otherwise I'm surrounded by Catholics in the pro-life movement and Christians, Protestants. And I was raised Protestant, so my grandfather was a minister. I definitely have a lot of that knowledge in me. So I'm very comfortable with it, but I also can acknowledge the fact that, like, when I'm speaking at universities and a lot of young people, their arguments for life can be very biblical sometimes, and that's not necessarily this universal language. And what I always tell them is, if there is a creator, which I believe there's a creator, evidence is all around, we're here, there's a creator, then the thing with the least human fingerprints on it is science and biology, right? Like our very DNA, our makeup. And so you can talk about the biology behind a child growing in the womb. And that is going to speak to a creator that there is something bigger and beyond. It doesn't necessarily have to be a neat, tidy Bible verse, because if somebody doesn't subscribe to even your flavor of Christianity, or religion, then that's kind of going to set up that wall and not allow you to just speak truth. And there's some big T truths in there, in a lot of people's different faiths. But so much of that also can just be seen in the actual creation by a creator. And so I think that that's where we've kind of had our message be a little bit different within the pro-life movement. But also it's not anti any religions or anything. Like, we have people who are Muslim, Buddhist, atheist. Obviously we have a lot of Catholic supporters, a lot of Christian supporters, and we all just kind of find that common ground. Like, what can we work on? We all value human life as human beings. This is a human rights issue more than anything else. And so we've been able to build a pretty cool, small but mighty army on those commonalities.
So we all want to make abortion unthinkable. I think that's maybe a way to put it. It seems like a lot of it comes back to poverty issues. Is it that simple? Just addressing global poverty even.
I mean, that's definitely a factor. I worry that there's something more insidious, though, going on that is literally an attack on fertility, on womanhood, on there's just something that I'm seeing kind of evolve, even with young people going out and like, well, I want to get a vasectomy, or I just don't want to have kids because the world's so awful that, like, why on earth would I want to bring children into it? And so this kind of attack on fertility is happening that, I mean, not to put on my tinfoil hat, but it's like you kind of see it everywhere. It's some population control stuff happening, and I think beating women down in this way, where it's like you've been told and given these messages your whole life that you are not enough. You're not pretty enough, you're not skinny enough, your teeth aren't wide enough, your hair's not shiny enough. Like, and that is from the second you start going to the grocery store with your parents and seeing, the advertisements and the magazines everywhere. Like, we're just constantly beaten down. And then, okay, well then how do I find approval? And then the next message is through sex, through being desirable, through getting somebody to want you. And so then, of course, that naturally ends up leading to unplanned pregnancies quite often. I know that's what happened to me at 16. And when you have all these messages that you are not enough, abortion becomes the merciful thing. Like, I wouldn't want to put a child through this. They deserve something better than me as a mother. And we become so vulnerable to having that lie sold to us. And I think that's what I'm seeing happen with this generation of young women, where it's like they don't trust themselves to be mothers. They don't trust the world right now. And young men, I'm seeing that quite a bit with, the 25-year-old guys right now who are just like, no, the world's terrible. It's actually unethical for us to bring children into the world. And in this economy, how could we? Like, there are so many just attacks on fertility that I think are happening. So anyway, sorry, that's my conspiracy on that, but I think there's something there.
I think there is something there. I think that there are many answer or many problems to solve to get to the point to where, this is what we love to do here on Dear Jane. We love to have pro-life people who come at it from different angles. And I think that's how the pro-life movement is going to move the needle, is that if we are, if what do they used to call it, the big tent in the political world, we've got to focus on where we have alignment, where we have agreement. Because I think we agree on a lot more than we don't. And so, I mean, you've been at this for a while now. Do you still get a lot of some pushback within the pro-life movement?
Yeah, of course. But I mean, that's a good thing I feel like about feminism. Like if you're not ticking somebody off, you're probably not doing it right. So it's part of the game. I mean, I think definitely our way of going about things, everybody thinks that they're doing it the right way.
Right.
And I would argue that everybody's doing it the way they're called to do it. And this is not homogenous. We are not all called to do it the same way. So cool. You take on this issue. Like, let me take on this issue because it is so many other things. Is poverty a huge like proponent of why people choose abortion? Absolutely. It is the four practical things we found is it's housing, healthcare, transportation, and childcare. So those are the four actual practical things that like, if we, you know, really make sure those basic necessities are provided through, you know, charities, community, however you want to do it, it is going to lower the abortion rate. But beyond that, I think that there is also this deep lack of community. And I don't even think it's, you know, abortion vulnerable women. I think any mother or, you know, single father in this country can tell you how isolating it is and how, you know, when my kids were little, I was a hermit. Like and I felt like I had to figure everything out on my own and I really wasn't sure what to do. And, you know, thankfully I did have family that I could reach out to. I had, you know, a mother and a grandmother and aunts and people, okay, like, how do I deal with this? This is crazy. It takes a village. Like, there's a reason that saying is so true. And we keep it in our, you know, cultural zeitgeist. And then yet we don't follow it because here in America, there's so much, just, it's so individualistic that you have to figure it out and you're on your own. And I think so many parents struggle with that quite a bit. And I also think that that's why it's been so cool to watch our moms at our shelters and the way that they come around each other in community. And I remember hearing this political commentator say, you know, we don't want people coming here and bringing their cultures. This is America. Like, we want our cultures. First of all, as an Irish American, like, we've got a million different cultures, but whatever. But I just kept thinking, like, that's so crazy because I would love more of that culture, quite honestly, of, you know, generational living and families that support each other. And you don't see as high of an abortion rate in a lot of, you know, those type of Hispanic communities because you do have family support. And so, why don't we embrace these cultural things? Like, I think that there's a lot that America could benefit from kind of learning to have those internal support systems in our community. So many of the pregnant women who call me don't have that. Anyway, I think that's how we lower the abortion rate.
So, well, let's wrap up here. So the website is newwavefeminists.com. And I noticed you've got, where could people find some more pictures and videos and just a better insight to what's going on at the shelters there on the border?
We definitely on our Facebook and Instagram are trying to share stories. We've been very busy and slammed, so I'm not writing as many stories as I should, but we are trying to get that information out. And then Karina and I, once a week, are trying to do also just an Instagram live where we're giving people updates on like what we are seeing because it is kind of changing from week to week.
Okay. Very good. NewWaveFeminists.com. Check them out if you want to learn more. Destiny, thank you very much for joining us today here on Dear Jane.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again for listening to Dear Jane.
You can follow along every day on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and X. And make sure you also are subscribed so you never miss an episode on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. Ring that bell so you're notified and you never miss an episode.